Today is Monday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, more countries cut flights to China despite protests from the World Health Organization.
There is no reason for measures that unnecessarily interfere with international travel and trade. We call on all countries to implement decisions that are evidence-based and consistent.
Plus, Australia's bushfires have hit the country's wine industry. And in the U.S., the Democratic Party begins its process to choose a nominee to run against President Donald Trump. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, the 57 new deaths confirmed Monday were the largest daily increase since the virus was detected late last year in the central city of Wuhan. China said Monday it urgently needed medical equipment and surgical masks as the death toll from the new coronavirus jumped above 360, making it more deadly in mainland China than the SARS crisis nearly two decades ago. The coronavirus also killed its first patient outside China. News reports from the Philippines say a Chinese man from Wuhan died in a hospital in Manila a few days after arriving there. The virus has spread to more than 24 countries despite many governments imposing unprecedented travel bans on visitors from China. The United States, Australia, Singapore, and a growing number of other countries are denying entry to foreigners traveling from China in an effort to limit the spread of the coronavirus. But the Director General of the World Health Organization is urging countries not to close their borders to foreigners traveling from China. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the relatively small number of cases outside China, fewer than 200 out of the total of over 17,000, can be managed without resorting to extreme measures.
There is no reason for measures that unnecessarily interfere with international travel and trade. We call on all countries to implement decisions that are evidence-based and consistent.
And as the new coronavirus has spread outside China, so has discrimination against Chinese people. Restaurants in South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, and Vietnam have refused to accept Chinese customers. Indonesians marched near a hotel and called on Chinese guests there to leave. And French and Australian newspapers face criticism for racist headlines. Meanwhile, there have been reports of racism against Chinese and other Asians in Italy, Singapore, New Zealand, the United States, and elsewhere. To look at this uptick in racism against Chinese in France, journalist Lisa Bryant filed this report for VOA from Paris.
Just as fast as the coronavirus is spreading, so too seems to be prejudice in Japan, South Korea, and Italy, and now here. This week, the French hashtag, Je ne suis pas un virus, I am not a virus, was trending on Twitter.
Un mec commence à faire agir.
This Chinese man interviewed on France's BFM TV, his face hidden so he wouldn't be recognized, described walking out of a Paris gym and being accosted by teenagers who laughed and said, "There's coronavirus coming." Ethnic Chinese aren't the only ones being targeted. One account on social media described a Vietnamese woman being shunned by those around her. Other East Asians say fellow passengers on public transport move away from them or put scarves in front of their faces.
Et on observe vraiment que cette situation a servi de, comment dire.
In a television interview, Laetitia Chive, head of the Association of Young Chinese in France, said coronavirus was giving expression to latent racism. It hasn't helped that a French newspaper, Le Courrier Picard, published the headline Yellow Alert on its cover last Sunday and titled an editorial A New Yellow Peril. The newspaper quickly apologized, saying the move was unintentional, but the damage was done.
J'ai vu passer la une du Courrier Picard. Je me suis dit, mais c'est pas possible. On est au 20e.
Interviewed by a colleague, journalist Lin Landau said she couldn't believe the Courrier Picard's title. We're in the 21st century, she said. All this comes after France reported a surge in racist and xenophobic acts in 2019, up 130% from the previous year. While much of the focus has been on Jews and Muslims, ethnic Chinese have also been targets in recent years. The government's line is zero tolerance to discrimination. In 2016, thousands of Chinese staged protests after a 42-year-old man was killed outside Paris by three men trying to rob his companion's bag. It wasn't the first attack, and Chinese anti-violence activist Tamara Liu says it hasn't been the last. Liu says the same prejudice behind these past attacks on the Chinese community, because they're stigmatized as rich and hardworking, and therefore good targets to rob, is being seen with coronavirus today. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The discrimination is not only taking place abroad. Voice of America's Mandarin service reports that within China, there have also been sentiments of fear, hatred, and discrimination against people linked to Wuhan, the city at the center of the outbreak. Now in the U.S., voters from the Democratic Party in the U.S. state of Iowa choose their nominee for president today, kicking off a primary season that will last for the next few months. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, former Vice President Joe Biden, and former Gary, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg are among the front runners. For the latest, we now go live to VOA's Kane Farabaugh in Des Moines, Iowa. Hello, Kane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, how have the polls gone so far? Any issues in the voting?
Well, voting will actually start to take place tonight when voters or caucus goers here in Iowa will gather starting at 7 p.m. local time to meet collectively with their neighbors and their precincts to basically openly discuss who they're supporting for their preference for the Democratic nominee for president. And they will organize in that room into groups according to which candidate they support. And the effort there is to be the candidate in that room who gets the largest group or the biggest group of supporters.
And so Iowa is a relatively small state, but because it's the first to choose its nominee, it has a pretty big impact on how the primary season will go. Can you explain this somewhat odd phenomenon to our listeners?
Well, it's a Midwestern state. It's not a very diverse state, and you're right, there are not a large amount of voters. I mean, when it comes right down to it, there will be perhaps several hundred thousand people that will turn out and participate in a caucus. But this is the first test for these nominees seeking to gain support and to gain momentum as they begin this race, which goes essentially through all of the states, on the quest to become the Democratic nominee for president to challenge Republican President Donald Trump in the November general election. So the effort here in Iowa is basically seen as the first test, and it's also the place where these candidates can build momentum and make a name for themselves to help them as the campaign furthers throughout the United States.
Now, there are a few front runners, and given, you know, polls in recent days and then also from the people you've been talking to, any indication who might be in the lead?
Right now, it's very crowded at the top. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders seems to have a lot of support. He seems to have a lot of momentum. Some polls have indicated that he's in the lead. Really, though, the race is tight at the top. There's four to five top potential contenders. As you mentioned, the former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, former Vice President Joe Biden, and, of course, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. All of these are really the front runners here, and they're all sort of crowded at the top in polling.
Now, these primaries have really split the Democratic Party. You have Sanders and Warren, who are running as leftists, whereas you have Biden and Buttigieg, who are much more moderate. How are Iowa voters, you mentioned it's a Midwestern state, how are Iowa voters in particular reacting or responding to these different visions of the Democratic Party?
Really, what's at stake here in the message on the campaign trail is boiling down to one issue. Who is the most electable, or who can get the most support to be able to beat Donald Trump in November? So while there are factional disagreements in the Democratic Party as to who they think that candidate is, really, voters, the biggest issue they have on their minds, because for Democrats here, the real issue in November is making sure they select a candidate that can beat Donald Trump. So the pitch is, who is most electable? And former Vice President Joe Biden is making the pitch that pulling around the country shows that he is the best candidate positioned to beat President Donald Trump. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are considered to be progressives. They're making the case that a lot of people support their views and they want to bring a radical approach to changing the way politics works in Washington and the way government works in Washington. We really won't know until after these Iowan caucus voters decide who will emerge as the person these people here think is most likely to be able to beat President Trump in November.
All right. Well, we will certainly be looking out for the results this evening. That was VOA's Kane Farabaugh in Des Moines, Iowa. Thanks for joining us, Kane.
Thanks for having me.
This is International Edition. The British government plans to announce new rules for the imprisonment of convicted terrorists after a man strapped on a fake bomb and stabbed two people on a busy London street Sunday before police fatally shot him. It was the second such attack in less than 3 months. The government said it would effectively stop the early release of convicted extremists, double terror sentences, and overhaul the conditions under which they are released back into the community. The Islamic State group said Monday the man involved in Sunday's stabbings was one of its fighters. And a leaked recording of an exchange between an Iranian air traffic controller and an Iranian pilot purports to show that authorities immediately knew a missile had downed a Ukrainian jetliner after takeoff from Tehran, killing all 176 people aboard, despite days of denials by the Islamic Republic. Both Ukraine's president and the head of the Iranian investigation team said the recording was legitimate. After the January 8th disaster, Iran's civilian government maintained for days that it didn't know the country's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard shot down the aircraft. And amid simmering Middle East tensions, a Japanese destroyer left for the Gulf of Oman on Sunday to guard sea lanes that supply nearly all the oil that powers the world's third biggest economy. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the Gulf of Oman is a, quote, lifeline, unquote, for Japan and that thousands of Japanese ships ply those waters every year, including vessels carrying 90% of Japan's oil. Abe's government has said it is prepared to authorize the warship to use force to protect ships in danger, a controversial decision because Japan's war-renouncing constitution forbids the use of military force in international disputes. The warship will operate independently of other navies in the region, including the U.S. Navy. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Chicago found evidence that supports a link between exposure to environmental pollution and neuropsychiatric disorders such as bipolar disorder and depression. The researchers analyzed information from a U.S. health insurance database which contained neuropsychiatric disease claims for 151 million people. They then compared patient location information from the health insurance database to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency measurements taken in various U.S. localities of 87 potential air pollutants. According to the study, the U.S. counties with the worst air quality also had a 27% increase in bipolar disorder and a 6% increase in major depression compared to areas with the best air quality. The researchers were able to validate their U.S. findings by applying their methodology to data called from similar data sets in Denmark. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. House lawmakers prosecuting the impeachment case against U.S. President Donald Trump and the president's defense team each have 2 hours Monday to make their closing arguments. The final outcome of the case seems secure, with Republicans holding a 53-47 majority in the Senate and none indicating they plan to vote to remove Trump from office. House Democrats will still argue Monday that Trump abused his power by asking Ukraine to launch investigations that would benefit him politically, and that he obstructed Congress by directing members of his administration to not provide documents and testimony during subsequent probes of his actions. Trump's lawyers and the president himself argue he did nothing wrong and that his actions do not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. For more, we go live to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson in Washington. Hello, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So when all is said and done, will this impeachment trial really change anyone's minds, not just in Congress, but among the American people, too?
Well, I don't think it's really changing any minds because we're in such a partisan political atmosphere, particularly in an election year. But I also think that will have an impact on the election itself. I think a lot of Democratic voters are going to be even more energized to come out and vote in November against President Trump when they see what they feel like is really a crime that the president committed and was never convicted of. This is really going to anger them. This is going to fire them up, and it's going to motivate voters to want to come out and beat President Trump.
Now, looking more into those political implications, an acquittal ostensibly looks good for Trump, but because there were no witnesses called, as you said, many Americans view this as an incomplete or obstructed process, which favors the Democrats. I mean, are there winners and losers on both sides?
Right. And remember that also anywhere from 60 to 70% of the American public said that they wanted to see these new additional witnesses and evidence entered into the Senate impeachment trial. And because that didn't happen, people may take a second look at President Trump. Some of those voters that are not in that 35% of his base who are really loyal, they may look at a Democrat, depending on who the eventual nominee is, and consider that person because they've seen this process with President Trump and they don't think that it was a fair process.
And so what's next now for the House and the Senate? The lead up to the impeachment trial and, of course, the trial itself, it was time consuming. It was bruising. It was, a real political struggle. What's going to be on the agenda for Congress next? And are these people going to be getting along?
Well, that's really the major question. And remember that because it's an election year, it's even harder for both sides to get along with each other. While all of this impeachment trial has been going on, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi unveiled an infrastructure plan back ages ago. Some people may remember that President Trump expressed an interest in working with Democrats on an infrastructure plan. Nancy Pelosi is a deal maker. She may be able to reach out to President Trump after the dust has settled from all of this and say, look, let's work together on this. Remember, she did it with the USMCA trade deal. She actually inked that deal with President Trump on the day that the House voted on an impeachment inquiry. So it's been done before, but as you said, it really has been a really tough couple of months with the both sides battling each other out. Some of that may still be lingering as we close that Senate impeachment trial.
About a minute left. Going back to politics, now a number of senators have been taken away from the campaign trail, and now that this is probably ending, they can get back to the campaign trail. What's the sense from their offices about how this has gone or whether it was worth it or what's next for them on the campaign?
Well, if you talk to some of the Senate Democrats who are running for president, they're going to say all the right things. They're going to say, look, this is my duty as a U.S. senator. It's one of the highest duties I can possibly have. They will say all those right things. But in the end, they all have private jets waiting for them today to take them to Iowa so that they can make it in time for those caucus results. They want to be there. They need to be there, particularly some of the lower polling senators like Amy Klobuchar, who needs to put in that face time in Iowa and then getting started on New Hampshire, which is next week.
That was VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson in Washington. Thank you, Catherine, for coming on the show.
You're so welcome.
And in sports, Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic won the Australian Open, defeating Dominic Thiem of Austria in five sets on Sunday. After winning the first set, Djokovic lost the next two to Thiem and needed a doctor to come on the court amid what appeared to be leg problems. But the Serb rallied to win the fourth and fifth sets. It was Djokovic's record eighth Australian Open title. It was also his 17th Grand Slam title, placing him just two short of Spaniard Rafael Nadal and three short of Roger Federer of Switzerland, who holds the men's record for most Grand Slams with 20. Here's what Djokovic had to say about his place in the history books.
I'm obviously thrilled to be in a position to still be in the mix in terms of conversation for the most Grand Slam titles, and at this stage of my career and my life, that's professionally what matters the most to me.
On the women's side, on Saturday, 21-year-old Sophia Kenin of the U.S. won her first Australian Open and her first Grand Slam title, besting the Spanish-Venezuelan Garbiñe Muguruza in three sets. And in the U.S., the Kansas City Chiefs defeated the San Francisco 49ers in the American Football Championship known as the Super Bowl. Here's Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes after the game.
It's amazing. It honestly is to win this game, the Super Bowl, for not only me and my teammates, but for the coaches, for Kansas City, who's been with us through the ups and downs, and the passion that they show us every year is unmatched. And to get that Super Bowl trophy and be able to take it back to Kansas City, it's amazing.
But the Super Bowl is more than a sporting event. Its halftime show has become a cultural touchstone in the U.S. This year's performance starred Latina pop stars Jennifer Lopez and Shakira. Lopez and Shakira played one hit after another while using the show to highlight their Latina heritage at a time when many Latin people in America faced discrimination amid a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. During the performance, Lopez draped herself in a Puerto Rican flag, and at one point, child dancers appeared to sit in illuminated cages, an apparent reference to immigrant children who have been locked up by the Trump administration. Bushfires in Australia have ruined crops in parts of the country's wine-making areas. The full extent of the damage is still being calculated, but some grape growers have lost their entire harvest to so-called, quote, smoke taint, end quote. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports for VOA.
The cost of Australia's bushfire disaster continues to climb. Thousands of homes have been damaged or destroyed, and lives and livelihoods have been lost. The nation's multi-million dollar wine industry has been badly hit. Vineyards have been damaged in three Australian states, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia. Some have been directly affected by the fires, while others have been smothered by a smoky haze. If grapes are exposed to smoke towards the end of the growing season, they can absorb compounds from burnt trees that give wine an unpleasant taste, making it unsaleable. This has led to many grapes being left unpicked. Stuart Horden is a senior winemaker with Brokenwood Wines in the New South Wales Hunter Valley.
The largest impact from these smoke events is certainly on the growers. The fruit crop each year is their income for the year, and they're heavily affected by it. There are growers that we've had to walk away from. There are growers that we've taken a significantly lower amount of fruit from, and that really impacts on their livelihood. And we need to make sure that those guys get through the year.
The unprecedented bushfire season follows the impact of a long drought in many wine-producing areas in Australia, which had already reduced the size of the crop. Adding to the financial costs is a fall in the number of tourists visiting vineyards because of the fires. There's also the realization that climate change will bring more frequent and more intense bushfires, and that the wine industry will inevitably be affected by more smoke in the years ahead. Australian wine exports are worth about $1.86 billion. The three biggest markets are China, the United States, and Great Britain. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A Turkish soldier and a civilian member of the Turkish forces died as a result of wounds inflicted by Syrian government forces shelling in Idlib on Monday, raising the death toll to six from four in the incident, Turkey's defense ministry said. The statement said Turkey was continuing to strike targets in that region of northwest Syria, quote, in legitimate self-defense, end quote. The foreign ministers of Russia and Turkey on Monday agreed that a deal over that contested Idlib region must be observed amid rising tensions between those opposing forces. Turkish President Erdogan said Turkey had struck dozens of Syrian government targets after its soldiers were killed in the region, which is the last major Syrian rebel stronghold after nearly 9 years of war. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening, everyone.